Hey everybody, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Nice to be here. Nice drive up today. I want to thank Sam for inviting me up to speak. And really was just a gorgeous day to come up here. I didn't have to reach back and get a beer every 15 minutes or so. Just look out and enjoy life for what it is, you know. But as simple as that sound, it's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life was getting to that point, you know. I grew up in a you know, the book talks about the family disease of alcoholism, and that's what I grew up in. I grew up in a family that was totally decimated by this thing, and only one alcoholic in it, but that was my mom. We called her Hurricane Margie, and when I was a little kid, that's what we called her, you know. She'd go tearing through the house like a hurricane, and yeah, I think what it did was what it did with me and my three brothers is it gave us some strange insecurity in life, you know. Like, it was like one minute mom would be all happy and skipping through the house and singing and everything, and you'd go, well, this is going to be a pretty good night, you know. And then she'd get the gin out, and I wouldn't think much about it. I'd just see it sitting there on the back of the kitchen sink, and she's drinking and doing dishes and doing the chores around the house, and so we start goofing around and stuff, and unknown to us, the rules have changed. Mom's disposition has changed. Everything has changed. The next thing I know, I'm sailing across the room because I've caught a backhand. For some reason, I was the only one that didn't quite know the rules of how things had to operate around the house, I guess. I seemed to catch more of that stuff than my brothers did, but it's the way it was. I'd be running around a happy kid one minute, sailing through the air the next, you know, and then she'd get a hold of me. I mean, punch you like George Foreman hitting Muhammad Ali or something, you know. And I tell that stuff and people say, yeah, we all had corporal punishment. And I go, no, that's not what this was. So it's kind of that weird way to grow up, coming out of that family disease of alcoholism. I became a good fisherman is what happened. We had a pond about 100 yards from the house. It kind of dipped down a hill. There were a couple of places you could fish from that mom couldn't see you out the kitchen window. And man, I'd camp down there as much as I could, and just to escape anything that might erupt without any warning. But all that said, I mean, I don't think that's what made me an alcoholic, you know. I've got three brothers, and none of them are alcoholics, so I can look at them and go, yeah, they came out of that same thing. They seem to be okay, you know. But I wasn't okay. That thing you always hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a hard time feeling a part of, you know. That was kind of me growing up, whether it was going to a kid's birthday party or whether it was going to sit in the first grade for the first time or whatever it is. I just felt that separation from life, separation from other people. And I don't know, I always thought I grew up in the country, literally in the middle of nowhere down in little tobacco farm, and nearest neighbors were like 3/4 mile in each direction. And I always thought my problem in life was we were so backwards and so ignorant of how the world operated and how other people live. We just didn't know how to fit in, you know. That was kind of my take on it. But I had some friends in high school. I ran track and played football, and those team members kind of became my buddies, a few of them, and that's what I did, but I still had a hard time if anything new was going on or some new situation or whatever. I'd always feel a little uncomfortable in it. Drinking wasn't a big deal. I mean, this place was so small, you could not drink and get away with it. I mean, everybody knew everybody. Word would get back home. If you got drunk, word would get back home before you did, you know. With that being said, I did start getting into that some my junior year in high school. What had happened is this tractor tire had blown up in my face, and I spent the whole summer up at Johns Hopkins Hospital and had this series of operations, and they never really could get this fungus that had been blown into my eye. They only had 2 cases of it in the history of the medicine. They couldn't find anything to treat it with, so at the end of the summer, they grafted this skin down over my eye and sent me on back to school. Well, the kids were very understanding about that. They called me Cyclops, and, you know, and that feeling of separation kind of grew, and I got, you know, I kind of got depressed over the whole thing, and my grades started to go down. Then I got kicked off the football team. Then I'm more depressed over that, and so my junior and senior year, my grades kind of took a tumble, and now it's time to graduate. The friends I have are headed off to good schools. I mean, there's really no jobs down there, nothing that You're either going to go off to college or you're going to have a rough outlook. So your friends are headed off to this school and that school, and I don't have the grades. I'm going to the community college down there, you know. And the only thing I thought about that was, man, I'm stuck here with Mom for two more years. And by now, I had started to drink, you know, and had some, never really had any consequences from it. I mean, I banged Mom's car up one night and stuff like that. But you know what we do? We talk our way out of it. We just, every kind of scrape I should have been, I stood in front of a state trooper at 16 years old and purchased beer, and the guy let me walk on out of the store, and just stuff like that started happening, but I never really got in any trouble for it, so I didn't think much about it, you know. And so all that's going on, I finally, so at this point, I don't really have what I would call full-blown alcoholism. It's like I'm just starting to drink enough, and when I drink, I do tend to get drunk, you know. I remember 16 years old, went to some keg party. I'm just throwing up all over the place, and people drive me home, and we're all making jokes about it, and I liked it. I mean, as bad as I hurt the next day, I liked the attention. I liked it, you know. I kind of just started to build a little rep around school and stuff like this, and just liked everything about it. So that's what I started to look at, and I didn't realize it as this stuff creeped up on me, but alcohol, like, started to weave itself into the fabric of my life more and more, you know. It was like, whatever we're doing, I'm like, all right, how are we going to be able to buy liquor? How are we going to be able to buy beer? What, you know, it's all starting to plan stuff around alcohol. And that goes on. So at this point, I'm able to knuckle down, you know. I said, man, if I don't do well in this community college, it's going to be a tough road ahead. So I made pretty much straight A's in the thing, and at the end of 2 years, I could go wherever I wanted. And I took off up to Virginia Tech, and, you know, I'm kind of on a roll with the grades now, and I want to keep that going. And but unfortunately, the drinking got really took off up there, you know. Did pretty well. Like, we were on a quarter system back then, and I think first quarter I made really good grades, and second quarter did okay, but I'm starting to drink more. And then we stayed up there over spring break, my roommate and I, and man, we just tore it up, you know, and just found this thing in common that we like to get really messed up. And so the rest of the year, we started to have some kind of drinking event for every night of the week. Monday night was Monday night football. That was pretty tame. We just go to the 7-Eleven across from our apartment and get the tall Budweisers and pound as many of those as we could. And then Tuesday night was a happy hour at the shop that made these super hot submarines that make you cry if you put enough jalapenos on these things. So you got to drink a lot of beer under those circumstances. And it just went on. I was in the cave club up there. So on Friday night, we would just go get a keg or all meet at somebody's house and just get drunk as a hoot and pass out there, get up the next day, get your caving stuff. You go caving. We're sober when we were doing that. We weren't ready to die, so we'd stay sober for that part of it. And then we come out and the party's back on. It's usually Saturday afternoon, late afternoon, whatever. We like literally climb up the rope out of the cave and like waiting for the other people. We start passing beers around or passing whatever around. And that was it. That's what we'd do the rest of the weekend, you know. Then Sunday, I was one of the main troopers here. They really relied on me in this organization. If there was any kegs or beer or liquor or anything left over Sunday, I was the guy that was going to finish that off, you know, or me and a couple of my closest friends. So we'd have these big parties. We call them furniture smashing tree pruning parties, because Kent would get drunk and jump in these little trees around the apartment complex and break them all to pieces. That was a tree pruning. And furniture smashing, I just get out of control and throw chairs at people and jump on coffee tables, and I just like smashing furniture. But that's what alcohol was to me, you know. If you ask a psychiatrist, they'd say the stuff's a depressant. It was like rocket fuel to me. I might as well get on a big rocket and light the fuse. I had as much chance of controlling that as I did my drinking, you know. I'm like, whatever it is, I mean, just a wide range of outcomes. I'm going to be throwing up in some weird place. I'm going to be passing out. I'm going to be fighting with somebody. I'm going to go out to a bar to have a good time with my friends, but I'm going to get ticked off and walk home for 7 miles without saying a word to anybody or whatever it was, you know. So my drinking's getting just really ramping up at this point, and I thought it was totally normal. I thought the kids that weren't drinking as much as me didn't know how to live, were afraid of life, were just little chickens, and just didn't have any need for them. The people I knew were big drinkers, and that's what we did, you know. So the dean sent me a letter and said, if you don't get your grades up, we're going to kick you out of here. And so this went on for the, I was up there for three, shouldn't have been up there for 2 years. I was up there for 3 years. And so at this point, I'm still at a place where I can somewhat control my drinking. Usually on any given night when I get started, it has a decent chance of getting out of control. But when I get in some bind, you know, and the dean wanted to kick me out was a bind, I can usually rein it in. I'm like, well, I'm going to cut back 70% of my drink until I get my grades back up, and that's what I would do, you know. And then I get the grades up, and then next quarter I'm tearing it up again, up and down, up and down. So that's how it went as I earned my degree in economics. I mean, it's a tough field now. It's tougher than it sounds. I mean, a more practical field would have been basket weaving. I would have at least known what to do. I would have at least known what to do when I got out with that degree. I mean, I had to put some keen alcoholic thinking to figure out what to do with this econ degree. I said, economics, I think a lot of economists work in Washington. I'll go up there. So without knowing anybody, I take off to D.C. and I start applying for all these jobs, and they're looking at my grades, laughing me out of all these government agencies. But I came pretty close. I became manager of a basement waterproofing company. You know, that same thing. I just have a trouble getting along with people and fitting into an organization and just doing my role and contributing and going happily along. I'm like in here. It's like, well, this is kind of a rinky-dink thing, but here I am. And I had these six salesmen reporting to me who had never, they'd been running their own show, you know. They go make a sales call when they want to, and the owner wanted to rein that in. He said, can you tell them where to go and then tell them, get them to tell you what happened when they went out there? And these guys hated my guts, and I didn't like them very much. And they're like, why are you sending me to Frederick, Maryland, and then down to Alexandria? Why can't I get two in Alexandria? I say, well, this is complex, man. I really had to prioritize these things. Just take your leads and be happy, you know. I don't know. They should have fired me. But anyway, they didn't get a chance, because what happened was it started raining and snowing, and this went on for like 14, 16 days in a row. But the best I could determine, every basement in D.C., Southern Maryland, and Northern Virginia were in duress. And the phone went from ringing about 6 times a day to ringing about 300 times a day. And the guy's going to ring the phone and scan the leads. They're like, God, just give us something to go work on. I'm like, wait a minute, I got 300 things I got to look at here. But just taking a good one and say, go talk to them. I'm like, let's get these and make sure we're getting the best ones, you know. And they're like, what is wrong with you? Just give them here. I don't know. That's how that went. So one day at lunchtime, it occurred to me on the way out the door to lunch, this is how much I thought about it. I said, man, I cannot do this anymore. I got in my truck to go to lunch, and I was blocked in. So I drove across a ditch and up on the right one, and I never looked back. I was just gone. The owner's son called me up. He's like, where are you? I said, I'm gone. And I said, by the way, it's your fault. He said, what are you talking about? You're the knucklehead that walked out of here. I'm like, you didn't plan for the flood. Anybody could see one guy couldn't handle all that stuff coming in, you know. And I was totally convinced that job would have worked out great if they had just had enough sense to plan for something like a flood. They were a basement flooded basement company, for Jiminy's sake. But that's really what I thought. And I started thinking about it. I'm like, why am I up here doing this stuff? And all those thoughts come back to me. I'm like, man, I just don't know how to fit in. I came from that backwards place. I don't know how the world works. And by now, I've got a second idea about life. I don't have the right education, you know. I went out there and I got that silly economics degree. I should have studied accounting. So I don't have the grades to get into graduate school. I go back to Tech for a year. I'm going to get an accounting degree. I take about 2 intermediate accounting classes and decided that might be hard. I said, well, I could take finance. That's pretty close to it, but I don't have to take all this intermediate accounting. And that's what I did. That's what I've done my whole life when I look back on it in sobriety. When stuff got tough enough, I run. I'm either going to talk my way around it, run away from it, or whatever it is, or just fear it to the point that the time to do it has passed and I've missed that opportunity. So here I come out with my finance degree, and I'm almost as unemployable as I was the first time, but the economy had improved a little bit. But so I go down, I start working for this consulting company, and we go to poultry companies all over the southeast and southwest of the country, and we collect thousands of operating statistics and put together these reports and go back and present them. And not like a normal audit company. A normal audit, you audit in teams. This thing, they send you out on the road by yourself. So I'm out here sitting in the hotel every night with my giant laptop. These things that just come out, they weigh like 40, 50 pounds, you know. I got the giant laptop, and I got the case of beer here on the bed, and I'm rolling along. I'm going to try to crunch through this audit so I can go back to Richmond Thursday and be there for happy hour on Friday and get drunk with my buddies for the whole weekend. I didn't like these compressed weekends this travel schedule put on me. Get in Friday at 10 and leave Sunday at 2. I mean, that was awful. So I'm going to try to get in a day early. So either I'm going to sit in the hotel, unless I happen to stumble into somebody in one of these companies that had an expense account and liked to drink a lot. And if they did, I wasn't going to work on anything at night. We're going to be out drinking all night. And just weird stuff would start happening, you know. It was like, I don't know, we're turning cars over and got the whole hotel staff, half the hotel staff is naked in my room. And I wake up in the middle of it and can't remember who they all are, why they're there, and but I figure this is how young people live early in their professional careers. And at the end of the first year, the boss is calling me into his office, and I said, well, this is it. I've been out here doing all this stuff. I'm going to get the real money. They're going to give me a raise, you know. And the guy calls me in there. He goes, Kent, we're going to have to fire you if you don't start doing these audits faster. And I'm looking around, and he did say Kent, right? That's a level of perception I had. I think I'm doing a great job, and the people are looking at my work going, what is wrong with this guy, you know? But here again, I knuckled down. I'm like, man, it took me forever to get any kind of job. I'm not going to lose this one. So I cut the drinking back. I hook up with a guy who's getting his master's degree in information systems. I start hanging with him. We start converting all these audits from manual to automated and everything. And suddenly, within the next year, and I'm working all these late hours, I've become a hero in the company, you know. He said, man, you've gotten to the, and they want me to go back and present the reports to management. They said, you've gotten to that level faster than anybody that's ever been through here. We want to give you a raise and get you on the road. I said, well, it's too late. I'm leaving. really, I mean, we got like 6 weeks coming up. We got to go present these reports. They come hand me the plane tickets. I'm like, no, I'm not your guy. I know you thought I was because I work here and all, but I'm leaving. And suddenly this place that I was so grateful to hang on to at the end of that first year, you know, I was like, wow, I dodged a bullet there. Now the whole thing's beneath me, you know. I'm like, people go count all the chickens they want to. And so I'd gone on to the next organization, which the chicken place actually fit me pretty well, you know. I'm country boy, this thing's laid back and casual and everything. And I go into this office of three-piece stuff suits, and then I go to work in there, and I interviewed 8 people before I took the next job, and I didn't like any of them. I like my immediate boss a little bit, and when I looked at it, I go, well, it pays more, it's got better benefits, and that's really all I looked at, you know. I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to look for some organization to see what I can really contribute. I'm not going to see where I really fit in and enjoy doing this, whatever we're going to be doing. I'm like, yeah, that's more money. Ching. All right, the decision's made. So I get in there, and from the first day I was in there till 7 years later when they finally fired me, I spent every day in that place wondering if I was going to get fired. I spent every day in that place thinking I was smarter than most of the people in there. Just a really, totally weird, alcoholic way of thinking, you know. I'm like, I could look at what you're doing and go, why are you doing it that way? I can think of a much shorter, easier, faster way and addresses more pertinent issues than what you're doing, you know. And then they give me an assignment, and I go, my God, how do I do this? And that's how I went through the whole thing. And So anyway, the organization started getting reorganized because our parent company got bought out, and I started getting through these things. So first time, they're going to do away with my department altogether, financial planning. So I go running down to a guy who used to work there with me. He's now down in sales and marketing. I said, "Robert, get me a job. Get me a job." So I'm like bugging this guy for 3 months. Get me a job. Finally, he says, "Ken, all right, go write it up. We'll see if we can get it approved." So he tells me what he needs done. I write it up as a job description. And then we get it approved. And Robert has saved my skin, literally, you know. And I thanked him profusely. After about a year of it, I went to the vice president of sales. I said, "Robert does not know how to use a bright guy like me. He won't let me work on any of these great ideas I have." And I didn't go to Robert and try to work it out anyway. I just thought he was a control freak, you know. And so that's how that went. And then we got reorganized again. I got away from Robert. I end up working for an alcoholic. I don't even know what one is, but I know this guy comes in with liquor on his breath in the morning and again after lunch most days. And I guess other people in the office noticed too. They finally called this guy in front of 200 people in the corporate office. He had to stand up there. He said, "I'm an alcoholic, and if I come in here drinking again, I'll be fired." And that's it. End of story. And so it shows we have some work to do with AA, with employers. How do you handle somebody who has a drinking problem, you know? But anyway, I thought it was great news because I'm watching this guy like a hawk. I'm like, because I'm scared to death of every boss I ever had and hated every boss I ever had, and this one was no different. I'm like, I'm going to catch this guy drinking, and this will be the end of him. So I caught him drinking. I start to rumor mill up. I think feels drunk, blah, 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 blah. Go around, but the guy was too well connected. From the day he came into the company, he was never going to get fired. That was the reality of it, you know. And so we're getting reorganized again. I'm extremely fortunate. I've landed on the right side of this thing. They're getting rid of half of our company, but I'm the guy that's going to stay. They said, "Yeah, you're going to be doing this, 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 and this. You'll get a promotion, blah, 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 blah." End of story. Well, 2 days before it's all supposed to happen, this Phil guy comes to me and says, he says, "Ken, you know, you've never really worked in some of these areas before. We'd like to see you do that for 6 months, and then we'll give you the raise and title and all that stuff that goes with it. It's a perfectly normal business decision. Here's a guy who's going to do something totally new. Let's see how he does it, you know." I didn't quite perceive it that way. I put my alcohol logic on it, and I said, "Man, they're setting me up to get rid of me. One, and two, my pride is hurt, you know. I'm like everybody else. Moved up. I look like some dunce sitting here without my doing the work, without the extra pay and all this stuff. I'm in self-pity and just deep in alcoholism. I'm not drunk, not during work hours anyway, or most of them. Some days we go out at lunch and have 3 or 4 big beers, but, you know, I'm pretty much sober going through this thing, and it's just like really grinding on me. And finally, I'm walking out to lunch one day kind of late, and Phil's coming back in from lunch, and as friendly as anybody on earth, he goes, "Good afternoon, Kent." I said, "F you, Phil." So I went out the door a lot faster than Phil did, and then I got fired from that, and you know, I'm starting to think, what do I want to do, what I want to do? And I said, "Man, I've done 10 years of this corporate stuff. They don't know how to use a guy like me. They don't understand a guy like me. I need to be self-employed. And so what am I going to do? I don't really have any money." I started looking around. I said, "Well, I could get into real estate pretty fast. Now I've hated salesmen my whole life, and suddenly, like that, I get a desire to become one." And I do. I go out and get licensed in real estate, and the heat is on. Because, see, the thing I forgot right before I was telling Phil what he could do, I just had a kid 4 months earlier, you know, my wife had, and she had quit her job to stay home and raise the kid a while. I'm like, wow, I've got to support this family. My wife has quit work. So that was a condition when I tell Phil this thing and get fired. And now I've gone into, from working, you know, salary, benefits, all that stuff, to 100% commission, you know. And so I'm out there, but I'm still able to rein it in. This is in my early to mid-30s, you know, and I go out there and I start knocking on doors. I knock on 300 doors a week, you know. Type of drive that alcoholics have in them. People say we're weak-willed. I think they haven't watched us closely enough. I go out there and I'm like I take over a couple of neighborhoods, and the business starts to come easier and easier, you know, and the economy is also starting to rise in the early 2000's part of it, and finally, the business is just rolling in, and I can't handle it, you know. I get to where I'm selling 7 or 8 houses in a month, and it just blows me away. I'd get so drunk you could not believe it. I mean, a normal person would say, this isn't going to go on forever. I need to be saving for retirement. I've got 3 kids now. I need to be saving for college educations. I'm like, done this. I'm a guy that grew up working for free on my farm and $1 an hour on the neighbor's farms, and here I've got $30,000, $40,000 coming in this month, and I just couldn't handle it. It just blew me away. I'd be just toasted, you know, and still trying to work. So that's what had happened. The drinking is continuing to ratchet up. All this stuff that I thought I would never do is now become acceptable to me. When I used to work construction with my dad growing up, every once in a while we'd have a drunk concrete finisher or carpenter or somebody out on the job, and I'd go, look at this clown. Why are they out here endangering themselves, endangering us? And suddenly I'm now running my own company, and I've got to get up at 5:30 in the morning and get messed up just in order to go to work, you know. So it was pretty crazy stuff. But what had happened is I'd kind of switched from alcohol. I became a type 1 diabetic, which is a weird story in itself. I went to get I still had that eye stuff going on decades later. I needed to go get an eye muscle surgery, and they wanted me to get a physical. I go to get the physical, and the guy walks in the room and goes, how long have you been diabetic? And I look around to see who he's talking to, and I said, wow, I'm diabetic, huh? And he says, yeah, you need to start on insulin right away. And when he said it, man, the anger just comes over me. I wanted to get up and kill this guy. And I go storming out of there, the doc in the box, as we called it back in the day. Today it's known as patient first, you know. And I go storming out of doc in the box. I go to parties across the street and eat 2 sausage and egg biscuits just to prove that this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And I went home and back to work the next day, and I was done with it. I was no diabetic. This guy was a clown, and that was the end of the story. Now, how many people could pull off ignoring a life-threatening diagnosis like that? I think you've got to be alcoholic to pull that off. And I didn't pull it off for long. Within a few months, I was down to 185 pounds, which is what I weighed when I graduated high school, you know, and I could barely walk up the 3 flights of steps to this apartment that we were living in. And so anyway, I'm like, well, I need to go get this checked out. I go down to VCU, MCV back then, and I said, well, they got some real doctors. Same story. Guy says, you need to start on insulin right away. So I kind of accepted at that point. And we start talking about lifestyle, you know, and I guess we hit on drinking somewhere, and then we talk about exercise and diet and all this stuff, and then I'm getting ready to hop down off the table, and I'm sailing down off this thing, and he goes, and if I were you, I wouldn't drink anymore, and I like freeze in midair, you know. I'm like, what? He said, and so I got on the floor, and I said, what, not even the... Not anything. He said, well, you could have 1 or 2 beers if you wanted to. And I'm thinking, why would I want to do that? But I did what any good alcoholic would do. I said, sure, and I walked on out of the door, you know. So I started running around to all my buddies. My wife didn't like me drinking as much as I needed to drink on the weekends, you know. And so I got 3 or 4 single guys around town. I go hang out at their house and party it up all weekend, you know. So I'm going around to these guys. I'm deep in pity, and woe is me. This guy's told me to never drink again, and they all said the same thing. They said, the Kent just smoke more dope. I said, now, why couldn't a doctor have come up with something like that, you know? I mean, and this is where my alcoholism took a giant leap forward. One guy said, I take it with me everywhere I go. Man, I'm a guy that had been laying down rules and rigid about when I'm going to be drunk and stuff my whole life, you know, and now this guy's like taking it with him everywhere he goes, so I feel like I may have been missing out. So that's what I did. I started taking this stuff with me everywhere, and I'm just messed up. I'm at 5:30 in the morning. I got to get up and get messed up before my wife and kids wake up, you know, and then I sit there and hide behind the paper and hope the coffee and breakfast smells are going to overcome the other smells in the house, and they're going to get on out the door and leave me alone, you know. And I'm still trying to do business, you know. I'd have a 1 o'clock appointment, and, you know, I finally get all them shooed out the house at 8:30, you know, and I need to get a little bit more messed up. And so I do. I said, 1 o'clock's a long way off. And then I'm standing there, and now it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and that uneasy feeling that comes on an alcoholic experiencing life starts to come on me, and I go, well, I could probably get messed up again here, so that's what I do. And then I got to call them up at 5 to 1. I'm like, man, something has come up. Like, too messed up to even talk to them, you know. It's just business sailing by. And but I'm a tough guy. I'm going to beat this thing, right? So I could not get up without starting to smoke this marijuana, you know. I'd smoke this stuff. Then I'd take a handful of antihistamine so I wouldn't be as messed up by it. Then I would drink a ton of water. I'd put Visine in my eye. And I'm out working, man, and I feel totally normal. And I think everybody looking at me would think I'm totally normal, except I reek because this stuff is all over my jacket and everything, you know. But Food Lion came up with a solution for it. He invented these things called lemon wipes. And I go in there, and I get about 8 tubes of them and put them in the floorboard, and I get one out. I'm going to see how this works. It really has a nice, strong, lemony smell. Yes, it seems to be working. Finally, after a couple of weeks, my face was just blistered from these things. And it's gotten totally insane. I'm like, I went over, I had one buddy, he told me, he said he had people coming to his house like rats to cheese for this stuff. And I'm hanging out with him. I'm one of his big buddies, you know. Finally, he's gotten a little nervous. He thinks the heat's watching him, and he says, Ken, I'm always going to let you and so-and-so come over here, and everybody else, you know, we're kind of cutting off the rest of the crowd. And I thought this was a great day. You know, the supply is going to always be there. I'm always welcome. I mean, what better news could you get, you know? I go over there one night to get some, and he's chasing some guy. The guy didn't usually get mad, but he's chasing this guy at the house, kind of yelling at him. I don't know what's going on. And I saw his little beagle was about to run out the front door, so I grab him. I've done him a big favor. I said, here, I got the dog. He said, you can go too. And, man, when he said that, I just like, vroomp. I'm like, wow, I'm going to have a long night here. I might have to go get drunk. That's what that meant. So anyway, but I start thinking about it, and I start hating this guy, you know. I've been friends with him for probably 8 or 10 years, and now I hate his guts. I'm like, how could he pull that on me? And so the next day I'm driving to work. I got my jacket and tie on, and I decided it'd be a good idea to go break in his house and just steal the stuff if he wasn't going to give it to me. I mean, he owed it to me, right? He said I could come by any time. So I pull a super can over to his 9-foot privacy fence. I go sailing over that thing like a 240-pound gazelle that I am. I'm in there. I get the dogs calmed down. I put a 5-gallon bucket up to his window. I dive through this thing, and I go in there, and it's like little paths through each room, and then it's like boxes and just trash. And the guy was a collector. He's got rock collections and shark tooth collections and musical instrument collections, and this stuff is just piled in. It's like a little path, and he collected snakes, which I hated those things. And you can hear them creeping around under all this garbage on the floor, and I'm under there looking around, didn't know if you're going to find something good or find a snake, but I'm in there looking. And so anyway, I stuffed my pockets up. I finally found the good stuff. I'm loaded up. I'm in an 8-foot windowsill, 8 feet off the ground in the windowsill in my suit, ready to go to the office. I said, something is not quite right about this. Man, that thought derailed me. Instead of going to the office, I had to go get messed up. I couldn't live with that thought, man, that something was kind of out of whack in my life, you know. And I'm messed up, and finally at the end of a couple of days, I can't get messed up anymore. I throw this stuff out the window, and I'm done forever. And this is 12 o'clock, and now it's 6 o'clock at night, and I'm trying to work. And I'm sitting here, and that uneasy feeling starts coming on me again. And I go, ugh, I threw all that stuff away. What was I thinking, you know? So I get my big flashlight, and I go find it. I throw it out on a busy road, but I'm going to win, right? I'm not going to be defeated by this stuff. I said, that was a dumb idea to throw the whole bag out. Anybody can find a bag on the side of the road. He said, if it ever happens again, which I'm kind of planning for it to happen again, right? If it ever happens again, I'll sprinkle it out of the window. And that's what I did. I, next time, go through the same scenario, break in, messed up, hate my guts, throw it away, quit forever, got to go back at 6 o'clock after dark and find it. And it's sprinkled out there. But I found it anyway, and I'm sitting here thinking, what am I going to tell the police if they come rolling up here while I'm out here looking for this stuff? And so that's how all that went. Fortunately, I never had a problem. My wife had a problem. She was too sensitive. My clients had a problem. They didn't like Mr. Lemon showing up to list their house. My kids had a problem. They wanted me to play ball in the backyard. When I least expected it, you know, if they had planned it out and I'd been just at the right level and everything, I could have gotten out there and played some serious ball with them. But they always want to do it when I plan to go do something else or when I need to go do something else or whatever. So that's how I'm living. And what had happened is my brother-in-law got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this was a disaster of a human being, let me tell you. I've helped this guy. He's trying to become a doctor, but he keeps getting kicked. He's been kicked out of medical residences in Illinois and Pennsylvania and Virginia. And I'm helping him move from apartment to apartment, and they're always a mess. And I'm loaning him money. And so this is a guy that said to me, you might want to try Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, look at this clown, would you? He couldn't be... The guy could not do anything, and he thinks I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I knew in here I probably should go try something, you know, because life's getting pretty rough. And my wife's really getting sick of this stuff, and my kids are not looking that good, and my health's starting to go down. And so I went to this AA meeting, and there are like 65, 70 people in there. So we're in there, and... I couldn't believe it, man. It just blew me away. I had no idea there were this many people fighting this thing the way I was fighting it, you know, trying desperately to stop and unable to stay stopped. I didn't even know anything about the broader aspects of alcoholism, how it had cost me a career, any of that stuff, you know. I'm just thinking, man, I really fight this drinking thing. I just can't quite get the handle on it. And there's a bunch of other people telling the same stuff. So I really related to it in that regard. And I want to do the thing, so I get a sponsor, but I never really call them. I start working the steps, but I stop at step 5 or step 6 because my keen alcoholic mind told me if I ever went out and made amends, I'd lose my professional license. So I never finished my step work. I didn't engage with my sponsor. I signed up for a home group and got drunk on the way home that night. Never really got active in that group, and so that's what it was like for 2 years. But I wanted to do the thing. I wanted to be accepted by the people in AA. I'd look at people at the core of these groups and go, God, why can't I get into it, you know? Why am I kind of on the outside? Why can't I stay sober? And so that's how I was in AA for 2 years, drunk in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years, but, you know, probably only drinking 10% of what I was when I came in there, if that much, but unable to stay continuously sober. And so finally, and I'm trying to do the thing. And so I'm on my third sponsor. He's got like 6 meetings a week he wants me to go to. And I'm going to him, going to him, going to him, trying to get sobered up in time to get to him, trying not to look weird while I'm at him. Finally, one day I was like, man, I cannot do this anymore. I've either got to get sober or I've got to quit AA. And I figured it out like that. I said, if AA worked, I wouldn't be having this discussion. I said, and then I had a truly sane idea. I said, this time I'll handle it myself. And out the door I went. So I'm out the door for 2 more years drunk and same stuff, same thing. You know, within a matter of days, it's just totally out of control again. It's like weirder stuff is happening. On and on it goes, and so finally one day, just the silliest thing drove me back in here. I'm pouring these patios on the back of my house, and my neighbor's retired Navy, old guy, kind of the neighborhood watchdog and everything, gets in everybody's business. I look up, and here comes Don, and I'm out here with my 5 guys, and we're all working, and I'm half-baked, and I'm like, oh, no, here he comes. He says, Ken, what's going on? And the normal guy would say, well, Don, I'm pouring a patio. Welcome to stay and watch or whatever you want to do. Good to see you. I want Don to like me. I want Don to understand I'm improving my property. This thing is so big, I'm improving the whole neighborhood. When Don said, "What's going on?" I need to tell him. So I started telling him. I said, "Don, this guy's going to grade it down 3/4 of an inch coming around that curve, Don." I said, "This guy's mixing the mortar, Don. He's putting in this many shovels of sand to this much mortar. This guy's going to squirt in these cracks with this little grout bag, Don. It comes out like tape mix. You ought to see it." And I went on for 6 minutes telling Don what I'm doing. And finally, Don got right in my face like this, and his eyes are bugged out, and he's looking a little angry. He goes, "Kent, you'd make a lot more sense if you didn't smoke so much dope." I said, "My God, the neighbors are on to me." I thought nobody knew. I've been hiding in the tool shed and hiding in the basement and riding up and down vacant roads. And I'm like, how did he find out? And I started thinking other people must know too. And that self-hatred that had kind of, this is no longer partying and fun. This is like just a rough thing I've got to get up and do, you know, to start moving in life. And that self-hatred comes on me again, you know, that recognition that I'm not being the dad I should be. I'm not being the husband I should be. I'm not being the person in my industry I should be. I'm not being the person in my community I should be. I'm not doing anything I should be doing. And that self-hatred hit me, and I just threw my rake down, and I walked in the house, and I went to look up the number of this guy. I knew I wanted to sponsor me. I met him right before I went out, and I just said out loud, "I'm done." And I called this guy, and he said, "Well, we'll sit down and talk about what we would do." I said, "Well, I just want to start, you know." And but we met, and, you know, I'm supposed to be out showing houses on Saturday morning. Every Saturday morning, I'm driving to Ashland to do my step work, and we get through that, and then the guy said, "Well, we're going to go to work now." I'm like, "What is he talking about now?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "AA is out there. It's not in here talking to each other." He's like, "We're going to go help some people." And a couple of weeks later, he called me up. He said, "We're going down to this corrections conference in North Carolina, and we want you to go." I said, "Does he know who he's talking to? He knows I can't go down there for a whole weekend, you know." And I basically hung the phone up on him. At this point, I'm 6-7 months sober, and I'm kind of getting a little irritated at this guy. And despite the fact he's given up all this time to help me, you know, and answered every crazy phone call I made to him and everything else. And then the fear kind of set in on me, and I called him back within 10 minutes. I'm like, "Man, I don't know what got into me." I had the idea. I said, "Man, I haven't been sober 6 months since I was 18, 19 years old. And this is the guy that got me there. Now I'm going to hang the phone up on him. It doesn't even make any sense." So sanity was starting to return. And I went down there and I got involved in corrections work, even though I'd never been arrested. And it's become just amazingly rewarding stuff to do, you know. But anyway, I got into AA and got into it a ways. I'm like, "Wow, I'm really going to make it this time if I keep doing what I'm doing." I had that realization, you know. I said, "Man, if I just keep going and keep doing what these guys are showing me, I'm going to be okay." And that's what happened, you know. We started, we really launched into this service work and sponsoring guys and going to the prisons and jails, going to BCU Hospital, going to Chippenham Hospital Detox, and all these other programs that we do through our home group. And when I did that, I started to see a real purpose and meaning in Alcoholics Anonymous I'd never seen before, you know. I'm like, "Man, I used to go to these 6 meetings a week. I would know what Joe was going to say about surrender before he said it." I'm like, "He just said it about 3 weeks ago. We were the same crowd sitting here listening to him. Why are we doing it again, you know?" It didn't make any sense to me. But when I get in front of a guy in jail and he goes, "Man, how do I stay? I was diagnosed with blood cancer today. How do I stay sober when I get back on the block?" I'm like, "Wow, that's a pretty good question, you know. I'm a sober alcoholic. I might have an answer for that. Let's sit here and talk about it and figure out what to do, you know." And the next week, the guy is sober, and I see that stuff, and so my life starts to take off the way the book describes, and all these problems start to power down, you know. How do I parent my kids? I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. That family I came out of was certainly no way to parent your kids, you know. I had to learn how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and today they're looking pretty good. Two of them are in the governor's school down in governor's school for arts and technology, and the other one's going to the community college, you know. He flunked out. I don't think he flunked out. I think he just quit. He quit chemical engineering down at BCU, and I was disappointed, you know. But back in the day, my alcoholism would have destroyed that relationship. I would have been in there like, "Nick, what in the blah, 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 blah is wrong with you? How could you blah, 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 go do this, go do that, go fix this?" I was like, no, it is where it is, and it came from me. If I have any problems today, I'm convinced I caused them. That kid did not learn how to screw something up on his own, you know. He learned that from me. And I'm like, man, what am I going to do, kick him out, you know? No, I got to figure out how to help him, so I go to work on that, you know. But they're all looking good. My wife sponsors a ton of women in Al-Anon, and she's looking good, you know. My health is better than it's ever been. You know, my alcoholism has almost killed me in sobriety, not through the drinking, but by letting that starting to back off that service and that alkalogical come back on me, and it's literally almost killed me. Back in the summer of 2010, I start feeling weird in my chest. It wasn't like anything I would associate with heart attack or anything like that, but I start thinking, well, I must have some kind of infection in my chest. And so I think, what could I do? I could go ride my bicycle in this 100-degree weather until I kill whatever it is. So I get out there riding my bicycle, and I'm just suffering, man. And so day one, and I still got the feeling in my chest, so I go back day two. And now I said, this is going to need some more help. So I start on the internet research. And I follow the Virginia Tech sports a lot still. And I noticed a basketball player had myocarditis, which is infection of the lining of the heart. I said, maybe that's what I have. Well, you would think a guy that thought he had infection of the lining of the heart would go to a doctor, for God's sake. Not me. I figure I need to bicycle harder. So anyway, I didn't read far enough to see that they had taken this guy off all activity. You know, I don't have that much patience. So I'm riding the bicycle, and finally the fourth day, I started to call my wife to come get me, you know. I'm like, but I somehow hobbled home, and I said, man, I better not do that. So I go to the doctor, and this young girl's filling in for my regular doctor, and she says, we're going to run an EKG on you. I'm like, I came here for antibiotics, you knucklehead. She's like, we're going to run an EKG on you. And I said, well, she's just being overly protective because the old guy's out of town. And she looks at it. She says, the cardiologist is right across the courtyard. I want you to take this over there and meet with him. And I'm like, she has really gone overboard. But so I'll go walking on over there, and the guy's looking at the thing. I said, looking at it. I'm going, well, do we need to run some more tests or what? I'm like, he's not diagnosing fast enough for me. He looked at me. He goes, do you want surgery tonight or in the morning? I'm like, oh, easy, doc. But, yeah, I had a 90% blockage to a third of my heart, you know. And here's the thing, though. In sobriety, I survived that, you know. Somehow I had sense enough to get off the bike and go to the doctor at the end of the day, even though I went through that weird alcoholic along the way. That thing would have killed me if I were still out there drinking. I mean, I just would not be alive today to talk about it, you know. And the type 1 diabetes, you know. Somebody, one of my sponsors said, well, what did you do when you got all stoned up like that? Eat lettuce? I said, no, I eat cheeseburgers and Doritos like everybody else. I'm thinking, man, I quit drinking the beer because it had too many calories in it for a diabetic. So that's how my alcoholism thinks, you know, and they say we're bright people. I'm just going to take their word for it. But, but you know, if I'd kept doing that stuff, I'd probably be blind. I actually went blind about 6 months in sobriety. I was standing in the backyard digging one day, working in the yard. Looked up, I couldn't see hardly anything, you know. Well, my sponsor's in medicine. I said, well, I'll call him up. This would be a good one for him to tackle. I said, here's what's happening. I'm in the backyard. I've gone about blind. He said, can you drive at all? I said, I've gone about blind. He said, well, I'm speaking down at Rubicon at 8 o'clock tonight. I think you should come down there. He's a tough guy. So I get in the car and drive on to Rubicon. I get in there trying to help some guys, and by the time the meeting's over, my sight's clearing up a little bit, and I go to a doctor, and he tells me what's wrong and get this under control and do that, and that's what I did. I couldn't have done that stuff in drinking the way I was. I could not have gotten into the doctor. I could not have followed his instructions. I could not have had the self-discipline to rein the blood sugar back in and get this stuff under control. In fact, he told me when it cleared up, he said, man, this thing almost never turns around. He said, I can't believe you turned it around like that, but you did it. So that's some of the stuff I get out of, you know, and just the ability to go through a day pretty sane most of the time. But you know, I get enough of the alcoholism coming back on me that I understand, you know, that what the book says is true. I'll get a daily reprieve from alcoholism by being sober and doing enough service work and helping other people get sober. Man, when I go to that prison, I'm going to be okay the next day at work. I'm not going to yell at a client or curse at them. I'm not going to destroy one of my kids. I'm not going to ignore my wife when she's got something she wants me to do. You know, I'm going to be able to, I'm not a saint. I mean, you know, but man, life is getting pretty good. It's been a steady upward trajectory. I mean, try selling real estate during the Great Recession if you want a challenge to sobriety. Man, I put three kids into private school and in 2005 when money was raining out of the sky, you know. And then in the fall of 2008, you couldn't give a house away, and I've still got three kids in private school. And I'm starting to go through my savings, 08, 09, 2010, 2011, finally late 2011, 2012. It starts to turn around a little bit, and I'm broke, you know. I look at it and go, so what? Nothing to do but go back to work. Yeah, it was a bad economy. It was made worse by my alcoholism, you know. Like, man, that fear of what I was living in. If I could have just gotten out of the fear and kept moving, I would have still been damaged, but I would have been much better off. But the thing is, I survived, you know. I've still got my house. I've built up another side of my business that's bringing in a decent, steady income now. So if I have a month without closings, I'm not going to miss paying a bill or something. I've been able to build all this stuff back. Same thing, without sponsorship, without doing that service work and getting that daily reprieve, I would have blown my brains out over it. That's just that simple, you know. That's the type of solution I'll look for in sobriety, because I'm not going to, man, I know I could get drunk again. I don't kid myself, but I think the other way out is probably the way it would end for me versus getting drunk again if things got that bad enough that I wanted to get drunk again. But I don't have to. All I've got to do is come talk to you people. All I've got to do is get out to that prison, get out to Richmond City Jail, get out to VCU Hospital and see somebody laid up in there with a broken neck because they drove their car into a tree or something. And I remember what I am. I'm a guy that doesn't even deserve to be here. You know, so I get on the gratitude side of the thing, and I keep moving forward. And when I do that, life's pretty good. And all these things I couldn't solve, you know, how am I going to parent my kids? How am I going to get the financial thing back on track? La-di-da-di-da, all that stuff just powers down, you know, and somehow we get through it. Not only that, but we grow out of it, you know. Like, wow, I did not think I could get through that, but I did. Maybe the next thing's not going to be as tough, you know, or maybe I can get through some tougher things. So that's what AA's done for me, you know. It's like it's let me experience life sober, which I missed the majority of my adult life, you know. I was experiencing it, but, you know, it was all a blur. It was all blotted. It was all it had that curtain between me and life that Bill describes in the book, you know. But just to get out and just enjoy a day like this and not have to be messed up in any form to do it, you know, to have gone 7.5 years without needing a mood-altering substance for a guy that couldn't get past 5:30 in the morning. Oh, just miracles I couldn't have experienced without Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you for having me here to speak tonight.